Well, good morning, everybody. My name is Jason Azapardi, and I'm the Library Services Coordinator for the Bug Island Comic Shop, co-sponsor of TCAP, the event that you're at right now. Thank you so much for joining us on Mother's Day. And you should be having breakfast in bed. I guess the best place to begin our panel on... Now, Mr. Robbins here wrote this title. will libraries save graphic novels?
Yeah.
I think it might be the other way around. Did you intend it to be the other way around?
No.
Okay. Then this is going to be a sub-question. Will graphic novels save libraries? Okay. We'll discuss as well.
We can look at both.
Let's look at both. It's pretty empty in here. Okay. So let's begin by introducing our panel. If you wouldn't mind giving a brief biography of yourself and who you are. What do you do?
My name is Lisa Hegum. I'm the Toronto Public Library's Senior Services Specialist for Youth Materials.
My name is Diana Molinjewski. I'm the teacher librarian at Agnes MacPhail Public School, which is an elementary school, kindergarten to grade 8, with the Toronto District School Board.
I have a microphone. My name is Scott Robbins. I'm a blogger for Good Comics for Kids, which is hosted on School Library Journal. And I'm also a library marketing manager for Kids Can Press, which is a Canadian publishing company.
I'm Kent Allen. I work at a high school in Belleville, which is actually just north of here. I teach mostly university-level Englishes, but I have a focus course on graphic literature, which is really awesome.
My name is Jim Ottaviani, and I write nonfiction graphic novels about science and scientists. And my day job is actually as a university librarian at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor.
My name is Douglas Davey, and I'm a children and youth librarian at Halton Hills Public Library. I was at Guelph doing the same job before that, and I do a lot of writing and presentation on graphic novels, especially graphic novels for kids. And what's your name? Beatrix.
Thank you, guys. A lot of us write graphic novels and comics. Mm-hmm. I guess we should call them comics from now on, since they're pretty much comics. As children, and then, you know, you're supposed to stop, and some of us do and some of us don't. And so, as adults, I was wondering what your experiences were. If we could, again, go down the line and talk about your experiences coming either back to graphic novels or comics, or why you continue to read them into adulthood.
I stopped reading comics when I was about 14, I think, because I realized there were so many books in the canon that I had to get through.
Yeah.
And so I went away from them, but then when I was in university, I came back to them when I was able to discover comics for adults, because I hadn't really been exposed to them until university. I probably was when I first started really reading comics for adults, and that's when I kind of went nuts.
I think my experience is very similar. I read comics all the way through being a kid. I stopped being a kid, I'm not sure. But all the way through being a kid, and then somewhere in the middle of high school stopped. And then my younger brothers were reading comics while I was in college. And I'd come home over the winter break and start reading theirs, and some of them were surprisingly good. And eventually they stopped, and I kept going. Much to my parents' dismay, I think. But now I do this nonsense, and I read even more comics today than I ever did before. Just like Douglas was saying, happened to hit it at just the right time where there was enough to interest an adult reader.
I started with Calvin and Hobbes. That's the only thing I would read as a kid. It's even better now, but I get the jokes more. And then going through university, you know, I went into English and was really heavy into literature. And then we had our son, and I started reading children's books again and started going, wow, this is great. This is what I should be doing in my class. And over the last sort of 2-3 years, I've been really focusing and pushing hard on getting it into education, using it in the classroom, and I've been lucky enough that everybody's backed me up. So that's where I'm at now.
I've been reading comics since I was I think, 10, and haven't really ever stopped. All through university, got into the whole Neil Gaiman, Vertigo, Sandman, the whole shebang, you know, adopted semi-goth kind of persona. And then after university, I worked at Scholastic in their book club division and was pushing graphic novels there, which parlayed into sort of a consulting position on their graphics line. So I was suggesting artists and writers for them to go after. So it's been really cool that I've been able to sort of parlay a childhood, you know, obsession into a professional expertise. So I'm happy about that.
Unlike the rest of the panel, even though I was a voracious reader, comics weren't my thing. I actually kind of discovered them later in life. I took, in 2004, I began my Master's of Education at the University of Alberta, and there was a course offered by Gail DeVos called Comics and Graphic Novels in the School of Public Libraries, and the light bulb went on, and you know, the little chorus of angels started singing, because it was such a revelation about the breadth and depth of what was available. And now my school library, I think, has one of the biggest collections in an elementary school in the board. And I also write a lot of graphic novel reviews for my colleagues. And I made sure, because my other foray is I'm the editor-in-chief of The Teaching Librarian, which is the official magazine of the Ontario School Library Association. And one of the things that I did when I became editor was to make sure we had Drawn to the Form, which was a regular column dedicated to graphic novels. So now I'm hooked.
I guess I read comics a fair bit as a child, and then didn't read them at all until I guess I started developing a collection in the year 2000 for a previous public library that I was working for, and I found myself in a position where I really had to defend this move that the library was making with our staff, and so I started, you know, that's when I just started reading all kinds of different graphic novels and became fairly hooked. Though I still am not an avid reader. I'm going to be completely sorry. I read some and I love them, but it's really been through my professional work that I've come to focus on them.
Well, I guess that's a good segue into my next question. The librarians mostly, I think, and then we'll hit the other guys. But what kind of roadblocks have you come across while trying to introduce graphic novels into the systems? Either from administrators or the librarians or even patrons or parents.
And presumably how you overcome them as well.
Yeah.
Thanks, yeah.
That's fine.
I haven't had too many roadblocks with the Toronto Public Library system, but I was working for the Pickering Public Library system. The staff was pretty resistant. I mean, I've never had any issues with patrons, but working in a public library, you don't actually get too many patron complaints. I mean, I guess the thing that does come up is sometimes staff makes an error and they shelve something for adults with the children's graphic novels, and that can be a bit of a disaster. But for the most part, the public libraries I've worked in, the patrons have really embraced the idea of having them, but some staff who just, you know, have felt that they're not worthy of being included in collections. This is in the year 2000. And what we did was we just did a lot of training. We got people reading things, and it really, like, staff went from being resistant to, you know, pushing them on the public. So I've had pretty positive experience in general.
I have a very similar experience. I have not had a lot of resistance. I I like to catalog the comics conservatively, so if it's on the edge of being a kid or a teen, it goes in the teen. The kids will find it if they want to find it, so that's one way of avoiding problems. But I haven't had a lot of problems with staff. They've come to me and said, are you sure you want this in the library? And I say, yes. Oh, okay. It's my job, and they, you know, that's... So I've had staff question it, but no one's ever... I did have both copies of the Black Dossier disappear before they even hit the shelf. So I bought some more copies. when I started at my new library, at Holly Hills Public Library, about 5 years ago, they had a jobber who was doing their graphic novel collection, and they had a collection about this big. But I looked at it and said, well, if you only have 20 graphic novels, that's a pretty good collection, except they had Preacher, you know, Preacher. Wow, like, this is a pretty conservative community. And then a month later, they had a complaint about I could totally see that happening. But I haven't had a lot of resistance to staff. I've also been doing, as you say, education, and I just keep telling them it's just another tool in the arsenal that we have of providing great materials for them.
Kent, do you have any in secondary?
See, it's funny. The library doesn't seem to have any issue because the beauty of it is it's given on student choice.
Yeah.
So, like, Blankets is put in behind the library. So we have a graphic novel section. It's really good. I'm a huge supporter of our librarian because she is so open to this. But Blankets is the one that she keeps behind her, and you have to ask her for it. And it's kind of like you go in shame and say, you know, can I please read Blankets, and she does give it out, though it's always in this sort of, you have to pull it from her hand, and
it has movies.
Yeah, it does, and I find it's a fantastic book, but I can't recommend it, because then I am putting myself in a position, well, he told me to do it, as opposed to I picked it for myself. Like, what I'm running into right now is I've got V for Vendetta, and I would like to do a full class novel study, but put it with 1984 in a similar vein to what I do in another summative assignment, and they won't accept it. They've denied V for Vendetta, and it's not the violence; it's the other thing, right? There's a man and a woman in a bed together, and it's funny. I asked Scott McCloud this yesterday. I said, you know, how do we get them past a visual, and you can describe two people in bed in a novel, and everybody's allowed to read it. But the visual, it's the static image. It's so much more.
My response is, it's just different.
Yeah.
And there's no changing that a picture is different from a book. So that's like when you start from that mindset. Also about doing V for Vendetta as a school study, the issue I might have with it, and people might not like saying this, is that I actually don't like the art in it.
Yeah.
So to study a graphic novel, which not only to study the story, which I think is awesome, but to study the art too, and the art's just not, I don't think it's that great.
Yeah. It goes with, I find they like the clean lines now. It's all, if it's computer done, they're...
Oh yeah, it looks so sharp.
I know, even mouse I have a tough time because, yeah, you're right. And I like it because it gives a really good story with a sort of traditional comics feel. Like, you're right, that it's that 80s comic, or, you know, yeah, straight panels. But it's funny, I don't, and Scott McCloud answered the same way I'm feeling right now. I don't know how I can, individual choice, everybody's okay with, but, like, I'm even finding for your the blog idea, they're asking me, okay, do websites. They love websites. Get your course on a website. And I keep thinking, yes, but if I put Blankets on there as a recommended read by me, where's the accountability? Because it flips to me as opposed to the individual. So now I'm kind of going, it's like a Tijuana Bible, right? Go read this because it's really cool.
Explain to them what a Tijuana Bible is.
I don't.
I will.
It's not a new Watchmen movie.
A Tijuana Bible is a cheap,
cheaply produced, small, pornographic comic that usually featured existing celebrities.
Usually from Mexico.
Usually from Mexico.
Diana, I know that you...
I know you probably want me to say, because I'm in elementary school, so I have students from that are 4 years old up until 14 that attend my school. Kind of enough, the parents actually aren't that concerned or worried. Occasionally I will get to one or two that will say, well, all they want to read is comics. And they say, well, that's good that they want to read.
There's 30
that point. So we make sure in my library that they can take out more than just one book at a time. And so I'll speak to the kids and tell them, okay, you know, your mom was really concerned about you. How about we do a compromise to make her happy, and you can take out, you know, some other book, and then you can take out a comic as well. So it kind of keeps them happy, and I can try to help educate them, to let them know that it's not necessarily a bad thing, that it's reading. We also, to be proactive, to use that hackneyed phrase, my students and I have a graphic novel review club. And what we do is, because the graphic novels are so popular, we actually have a grade by grade. You can take this out when you're in grade 4 or up. You can take this out when you're in grade 5 or up.
Yeah.
Just mostly for management. And then what our graphic novel club did, and I get them to write, or they get a signature from their parents to make sure that if they read anything inappropriate, they're not going to be offended, that it's just... And they preview them, and we check them out, and we have a discussion, myself and the students, about, well, you know, should this really be grade 5 or up? Should this be... And it's interesting, because sometimes the kids are liberal, and sometimes they're conservative. So, for instance, Beat the Vandal Buster, which I had tagged as grade 5 and up, and I mean, it's sort of, oh, well, it's grade 5, grade 6, because there's so much individuality between readers, so I understand that I'm kind of playing a bit of a shell game here. But my graphic novel club said, I think that maybe we should make it grade 6 and up for now. And the guidelines are always available to be negotiated. And sometimes, if you have that reluctant reader that you know the comic will get them, you sort of say, okay, you tell me what else, right? You have this. And so you have that flexibility at the same time as you have the rules in place.
Fantastic. I'd like to direct my next question to Jim and then Scott. I'd like you guys to briefly talk about the process of creating graphic novels. I know you've both sort of been there for a while, Jim obviously, but Scott also from the germination of the idea, right? So, Jim, would you mind talking about why you choose a certain topic and your process, what audience you have in mind?
Right. Well, the choice of topics is almost entirely selfish, in the sense that I usually write about stuff that I want to know more about, because there's no better way, no better excuse, I guess, to learn more about something than to decide that you're going to write a graphic novel or a book or write about it in any way, shape, or form. So that's why some of my output has seemed a little bit scattershot, maybe at times. All of a sudden I write a book about stage magic and I kind of shoehorn the science of illusions and the psychology behind illusions in it, just because I all of a sudden got interested in stage magic and wanted, you know, how do they float the princess above the stage and pass the hoops under them? And it's physics, and it's an interesting machine that they develop. So, in terms of the germination of an idea, what I read in the newspaper or magazine or heard on the radio or had always been curious about and a librarian had recommended a book to me or whatever it might be, sort of kicks that off. And then it's a question, and this sounds so pandering to this audience, but I go to the library and I check out a lot of books and I read them, and then I check out some of the books that are listed in the reference, and you know, it just goes on from there. And at some point you have to force yourself to stop reading, because there's always one more to go after and see where the story is, the narrative might be in this collection of facts that you found so interesting to begin with, or that presented themselves in the course of doing all the research. And then it's a matter of the most boring process in the world to observe and the most exciting process in the world to take part in, which is sitting in front of a blank page or sitting in front of a blank screen and making stuff up. And telling people, and then, you know, you also get sort of this godlike power, at least for me, since I always work with artists, of telling artists I like what to do. I want to see you draw this. and it's quite lovely, because what comes back often is a little bit different than what I envisioned in my head, and is a little bit different from what I wrote on the page. So I get to see this story one more time out of entirely new eyes. And that's why I think you hear sometimes novelists who work purely in prose say, by the time a book comes out, I am so sick of the thing that I can't even stand to sign it for people when it happens. I don't think that's ever going to happen to me, because by the time the book comes out, it's something entirely different than what I actually thought it would be or had in my hands when I started. And so it's amazing. Everyone should write graphic novels.
I guess I could talk about the process from sort of a publishing angle. You know, in a perfect world, you obviously look at your market and see if there's holes in a market, or what's the demand, or if there's a lot of books about vampires, do you try and find a graphic novel about vampires that's different than what the vampires are out there, or do you try and predict what the next big thing is going to be? And it's sort of it's a real toss-up. But then also you look at, what key creators are out there that are doing work for, that are sort of up and coming that you might want for your list. You look at your list itself. Are you missing a book for boys? Are you missing a book for girls? Are you missing a humor book? Are you missing a fantasy book? Are you missing a YA-teen graphic novel? So it's sort of like a puzzle. You have to put all the pieces together so they all fit. Publishers don't always work like this. This is, from my experience, this is what I would do if I was the head of a publishing company, but I'm not, so, I can give my suggestions to people, and, yeah.
Do you have an audience in mind when you release it?
I think, especially with, I think that if creators work to audience, it starts to get a little dangerous, because you don't want creators to feel limited. You don't want creators to feel like they have to dumb something down, or they have to, make something more mature. They should just be doing the work, and it should be the editorial people that say, this book is for a 9 to 12 audience, let's not have any sex in it. Or, this is a YA audience, but we don't want to push too many boundaries, so let's, get rid of this part of it. So it's really up to the publishing company to sort of shape the book for the intended audience. But again, sometimes it's a toss-up. Like, sometimes a book will, I find with graphic novels, one of the big things that's happening right now is graphic novels for very young readers, like ages 7 to 10, like the Toon books. Or even Baby Mouse, published by Random House. And in a lot of cases, those books are geared towards sort of a grade 2 to 4 audience. But kids in grade 6, 7, and 8 are reading them because it's recreational reading. Graphic novels have this interesting place in literacy that they can span a much larger age than what they're intended for, because kids like reading graphic novels. So that's what's kind of really cool about graphic novels.
So, Scott, what do you think about those Phonics comics?
I think I've read a couple of them. The Phonics comics are published by, I know they're like an educational comics, and they've got essentially they're used
to leveled readers.
Yeah, they're like leveled readers for kids, and they've got vocabulary lists in the back. Some of them are good, and some of them are awful.
Yeah. Some are funny and cute.
Yeah.
And some are
terrible. it's the same with like some learner stuff, which is again very sort of educational focused. And some of it is great and some of it isn't. Again, it's a toss-up. It's if the creator does good work, if it works in the marketplace, you never know.
I want to reiterate what Scott said about the shaping, I think, and about this notion of a very fluid boundary, which I think Diana was also saying, something about the, where the readers lie. And the experience I've had with publishers and with strong editorial hands is very much in that vein. Here's the type of book we want. Write a draft. And in that sense, the creator has a great deal of flexibility to write that first draft and get the basic story down on the page to work from. And I found that very useful, helpful, and somewhat liberating in the sense that I could get it all out there. And then for a book about the space race, for instance, that is targeted towards, I think, a 10 to 12-year-old audience as the primary audience. So there are things that you can do for that audience. If anybody's ever seen footage of, you know, the 1960s astronauts and mission controllers, everybody smoked. Nobody smokes in this book, but that's okay, because that's mostly a trivial detail, I think. It doesn't really add or subtract to the story. But what you can also come to an agreement with, and I've had this with both the specific YA experience I've had, is that speaking with an editor's, if you know the term, we agreed that our readers, however young they might be, will have to bring their A game to the book. And with the notion, especially with something nonfiction and somewhat science-based, these are going to hit an audience of readers who will like to, aspire to, and often do read up a little bit.
Yes.
So keep it entirely age-appropriate in terms of content. No smoking, no swearing, none of the things that would cause any of the librarians here to get in trouble with a school board or with a parent. But at the same time, move them up. So, as you said, it's scheduled for a fifth grader, but go ahead and take a kid.
Yeah.
It'll be fine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and Jim, you specifically do graphic novels that have an academic application of some kind.
Right, and education is never my main goal.
Yeah.
Education is a useful and pleasant byproduct,
yes, yeah.
or aftertaste, or whatever you want to
call it. That's
whatever you want to call it.
So, what do we do with graphic novels that are sort of pure pop entertainment? And I know that you probably have a lot more patrons coming in asking for that kind of stuff, and the circulation increases, but have there been any problems with justifying things that are like purely fight scenes or...
So that's the paper actually I'm going to be writing for, I forget what it's called, Graphic Novels and Library Archives, and I haven't written it yet, so I don't have all the answers yet, about how you balance that... The popular titles with the classics or the ones that you want the kids to read. And like I said, I'm still working on the paper. But one of the things is the classic book talk. The you read it to the kids and they want to take it out. So, I did a survey at my school a couple years ago, and yes, you know, they want their Naruto, they want their Prince of Tennis, they want their Ultramaniac, but if you take just, sometimes it's as little as 10 minutes to do a mini lesson on this graphic novel that they may have overlooked, all of a sudden you've got people banging down your door for it.
But I think that with it, even like the pop graphic novels, you can always find some kind of application, whether it's like character education or understanding the graphic novel form there is always something you can find. Like, I don't think there is any graphic novel that's published that you can just say, oh, this is just fluff. This is just, like, you can always find something because it is, a fairly, within the library and the educational world, it's a fairly new thing still. So people are still trying to figure out, what this is and how to...
Even just inferring. Like, yeah. That's a, big thing in literacy in the school boards right now are making connections, the big idea, and inferencing. And comics are perfect for that. Like Owly, which is wordless, is fantastic. So I think I totally agree with you, Scott. You're going to help me write this paper later, right?
Sure.
Okay.
I like the fact that sometimes you do give them books that aren't the very good. Especially the nice thing about a comic is it's so short. I mean, give me a break. It's a 20-minute investment, and you're never going to know what you like until you found out the 10 things you don't like. So here's a comic from the 70s. Why is it different? Why don't you like it? And they don't. They, like, anything, like I said, I think it's from the 80s, 70s, even earlier. It's a tough sell. They have to be an avid comic reader to enjoy it. And that's the kind of thing I really get into. I've used terrible comics before to start saying, okay, well, why is it bad? You know, it's one thing to say, no, I don't like it. It's another thing to say, why? And there you go. And then, you know, go write about it, present about it. If you're that avid to come up to me and say that, you know, I hate this so much, well, then stand up in front of everybody and voice it, right? And it's a perfect venue for that. And then you start going, okay, why'd you like this one then? And then, you know, you have a double connection on it, and at least they're reading. Like, I mean, that's the big point I'm finding right now. Just read, you know? So I don't understand when parents complain about comics, because they're reading. They're not only reading, they're getting visual, they're engaging in something. Like a movie takes 3 hours. You know, a novel takes 15 hours. A graphic novel takes 8 to 10. There's your happy medium. They're doing, you know, a lot of the best of all the worlds, really.
And do you feel that comics are unfairly held to some sort of level of sort of juvenilia that doesn't exist in movies and television?
Definitely. And they're categorized differently. Like, you can show a wretchedly horrid, violent history movie in history class, but if I were to hand out an incredibly violent graphic novel, then kind of people go, whoa, you know, and they get their backs up. And I'm always saying it's the same thing, but different, right?
Well, I was talking to this one teacher yesterday who was saying that, you know, oh, you know, graphic novels are a great way to get kids to start reading, and then they'll move to actual prose books. And it's like, no, it's not a jump. It's a parallel thing, and it's still, you know, the reading a graphic novel is, you know, you're using different you know, functions in order to sort of understand it as prose. But it's not like, oh, you know, words and pictures lead to just words, because words and pictures are easier, and sometimes they're more difficult, they're more challenging.
Yeah, like, go read Violent Cases.
Yeah, exactly.
If you want to tell me a graphic novel is easy, go read Violent Cases and then see what you get out of it.
For the most part, do you find these parents that are resistant, or this is a librarian that you're talking about that's keeping blankets by the desk?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm shocked by that. I just think it's disgusting, but
Lisa,
I know it's different.
I have another teacher librarian who took a marker and inked out any nipples they saw in any graphic novels they owned. Yeah. Inked them all out.
Oh, it's like that.
Some people, mainly who are not reading them, too. Like,
that's a big part of it, as far as I'm concerned. Like, when I sent V for Vendetta to the superintendents, because it has to be approved by the superintendents, and I think they looked at 6 pages.
You know, or watch the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, exactly. Because within 2 days I'd had a reply.
I mean, this happens with prose work.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But I guess I'm just thinking of something like Blankets that, you know, has all these incredible reviews and so much behind it. It's kind of shocking to me that that can happen.
Yeah.
If someone was to actually sit down and read it, they would see the context.
But it's much easier to put your feathers up than it is to invest the time. And I'm finding, too, I guess, I don't know if elementary may have it, but I'm finding they're not, they're streaming, like, if I said it was a college course, fine. No one cares. I see it's a university level course, it's an academic level course, and they start, you know, pulling, well, it's, is it academic? Is it valid literature? Like, even in my graphic literature course, well, where's the novel? That was the first question I got. So I had to bring in a novel. And
what did you bring in?
I brought in Night by Elie Wiesel. I do a comparison with Mouse.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is beautiful. Oh, it's fantastic. Yep. And so I found my somewhat happy medium, but even still, I think they do approach my books much differently, especially at a larger level. And I think that the rider is that it's one thing for a teacher to do it, but when a superintendent signs their name on it, it usually, the comments don't go at me, they go at the board. Right, and we're a fairly rural school, so I mean the clientele may not be as accepting to some of the ideas and some of those issues, but it's interesting. Like, I don't know, it's a weird one. It's kind of like that you know, the Art Spiegelman thing where they wouldn't let him have the woman's torso on the front, but they could show every other stereotype, right? I use that as a really good intro to the course, sort of saying, this is what you're going to deal with right off the bat. So it's interesting. I'm with Scott McLeod. Like, I don't know about a lot of these things, and I'm fairly new to it. So I'm looking for a number of fights to come down the road, because I want them doing it in every course, you know, not just making it a focal course. If you want my focal course to run, you're going to have to start promoting it in grade 9, grade 10, and I'm the only one that does it at my school. And I'm even writing units for other teachers, and they're kind of like, no, I don't really want to read that book, or, you know, and it's like, but it's not for you. You know, you are handing this down, so maybe you just stand up in front, like, say you don't like this book. You know, I'm going to be the only advocate against this book. You prove me wrong. Like, what a great lesson. What kid doesn't want to take their teacher on, right? But getting them to accept that and understand that, and they all go with me. You know, I'm the young guy, so I don't have the 13 years, 25 years of experience, and I don't know how things work. And when they get to post-secondary, they're not going to be reading these things. And it's kind of like, well, come with me this weekend. I'll prove you wrong.
Yeah.
And it's kind of neat. My numbers are so high that they can't really argue with me. Like, I have 33 in a 12U course, and I have a waiting list of 17, and they won't run two sections of it. I have a college section of 16, and they still won't run it because it still hasn't, it's got to establish itself, and I'll buy into that, you know, but I expect it to establish itself. But,
well, let's talk about circulation then. So they've been in catalogs now for, pretty solidly for 4 or 5 years now, I would say, right? And in a big way anyway. So what kind of circulation numbers have we seen, and the reaction from the patrons, like in the public libraries, in the elementary, the secondary, and then what kind of reactions have you Jim, received, and Scott, when you guys release your graphic novels?
I'll go first.
Sure.
I do a lot of library and school conferences, and last year I found that the librarians have always been a huge supporter of graphic novels, like ever since like the early 2000s. Actually, it was librarians who really sort of brought graphic novels to the forefront. Thank God. And finally, most teachers in the United States are now getting on board with it as well. I was at the National Council of Teachers of English conference back in November in San Antonio, Texas, and Kids Camp Press is publishing graphic novels now, and we were handing out free advanced reader copies, and people were going crazy over them. They were just like so happy that they're like, oh, graphic novels. I've been away from teaching for a couple years, but I hear this is the new thing now. This is the next big thing for teaching. So hopefully that will trickle down, and you know, it'll actually happen for Canada as well.
Jim, do you want to? What's the reaction been to your releases?
Well, I think it's the reaction has been uniformly positive among libraries and teachers. I don't market the books directly to that audience. Again, education is not the main point of what I do. And oftentimes people say, so do you market these to schools? It's like, well, there's not like one big school store that every school shops from. So, you know, coming from the United States, living here in North America, if I were to market it to every school, I would have no time to write, no time to sleep, probably no time to breathe. So it's more along the lines of they trickle in, and they have been trickling in here and there. I find out about their use in college classrooms. I find out about their use in elementary schools as well. And most often I find out about that directly from a teacher or through some secondary source.
For me? The listserv.
Yeah, the listserv. my favorite way to find out about it, the book about women scientists being used in the Maryland public schools, was I was washing the breakfast dishes, and it came up on NPR.
Oh, wow.
You know, here I am, you know, scrubbing some pan, and it's like, and yes, we're also using dignifying science in our curriculum now. It's like, that's nice.
And did you run to Amazon to see where your ranking?
No, my hands are full of soap and grease. You know, so that's the level of fame you can expect as a graphic novel. When you do something like that.
You still do your dishes.
I still do my own dishes. My basement is only half painted. All these things. So most of it comes in through secondary sources. largely because I'm not a genius marketer, but it's always been positive and always been very accepting. So for that, I'm quite grateful and very happy.
Doug, did you want to talk a bit about the numbers that you
Sure. My circulation numbers are always excellent. The trashier the book, the higher the numbers. So I can have Naruto going out, not that I can say Naruto trash, you know what I mean. Naruto can go non-stop, like they can just come and go and come and go, and then I can have Persepolis, they can go 3 times a year, and I can push it on everyone I see and still go 3 times a year, but I'm not getting rid of it, so I'm keeping Persepolis until the walls fall down.
Going
back to what someone was saying earlier about sort of teacher acceptance, I've been doing articles and book reviews and library presentations. The first library presentation I did, a presentation about graphic novels to librarians, I was in like a corner of some trade show, and I was stuck in the corner and I had like 2 people, and now when I do them I get a lot more people, and I was just approached by a group of librarians who wanted me to do a presentation for them, and they said, everyone, we all get it, like we all know about graphic novels and that they really work great for our school, we want to know what to do next. So that was really exciting, because it meant that all the work that we've been doing is, you know, it's filtering down, it's people, libraries were getting it, and libraries are purchasing them. So whether that means they'll save graphic novels or not, but it certainly legitimizes them.
So how can they familiarize themselves with the medium, other than reading them themselves?
Teachers or teacher librarians. Well, conferences are a really big thing. So I've got, every time I do a presentation, what people always ask is, do you have a book list? Like, I can talk, like I do one presentation that's all about the conventions of graphic conventions, like thought balloons and things like that, and people are really interested in it, but at the end, do you have a book list? It's not really that kind of presentation. So that's one way. People are really interested in getting building up their collection.
Do you have a book list?
I have a lot of few book lists, but I don't have many book lists for that one.
They're not universal.
Yeah. One way to familiarize yourself with is journals. So when I write for school library journal, and every time I do, I get comments from people saying, I really like your review, or are you crazy? I beg them to stop giving me prose novels, because my reviews didn't seem to match up with the general population. In one case, remarkably so. So.
Has anybody had any experience with book clubs to sort of promote them within the libraries?
Yes, although they promote themselves. They really do. Another way of familiarizing yourself, and actually Cindy's in the back of the room there, and we belong to a group of educators in the GTA who meet and we read graphic novels and we sit down and we talk about them. And talk about
any
the
pizza. Any pizza
and occasionally. But I want to come back to your circulation.
Sure, please.
Because my circulation statistics don't always necessarily reflect reality, and that's because my grade 7 and 8, what they do is one person will take them out, and then they'll lend them to their friend, who will lend them to their friend, who will lend them to their friend, who will lend them to their friend. The book's been read 10 times, but according to my computer, it's only been once.
Right.
However, speaking to the kids, you'll know that they've read. So sometimes my circulation statistics are a little bit misleading and deceiving, because...
Not that I'm encouraging this kind of behavior, but if you ever want to make sure a book goes in, you just check it in and out yourself about 5 times, and then it stays off the weed list. Especially if it's not from your area. Because the mouse used to be in the 741 adult section before I moved it to the graphic novel section, and I don't look after that section, so I just check it out. Now it's not getting picked up by the weed list. So I'm encouraging that kind of behavior, but if you want to make sure somebody stays in, that's a way to do it.
Also, Jamie's recording.
It's being recorded, yes. Yeah.
Frank Collar. For about 10 years, I know other people here are on this list too, I've been participating in the graphic novels and library listserv,
yeah,
which can get a little heavy duty at times, or detailed at times, especially about manga. But it's another great way, because people are always popping in,
and saying, asking, well, newbies are always coming in asking the same questions that, they are always.
Yeah.
It's nice to know that everyone has the same problems. Like people come in and say, I want to do this, but my administration says no. So there's a huge archives of recommendations or comments that people have made. So if you go to the Graphic Novels and Libraries Listserv homepage, then you can go through all the archives. I know I've done that to find out when people recommend your books on a certain topic. I've gone back to the archives to dig it out again.
I guess one last question before we open up the floor to questions. But can anybody sort of foresee where a relationship and between comic book creators and publishers and libraries might go in the next 10 years or so? Do you think there'll be like sort of a symbiotic thing where curriculum is given to the publishers and libraries are and creators sort of invent the graphic novels around that curriculum, or
there's a whole lot of really terrible nonfiction graphic novels out there. I mean, there's a lot of really fantastic nonfiction graphic novels out there, but there's some factory-produced graphic novels out there.
Right.
I had a review about George Washington. That was one of the worst things I've ever read in my life.
Right.
It's like pulling teeth to get through it. So that is already happening, where there's the curriculum exists and graphic novels are being produced to satisfy. I think by the time you know you've really made it, when people are using you, when people are using cheap knockoffs of higher quality material, that's when you know you've really made it.
I think that publishers are realizing the sort of grassroots power that librarians have in terms of getting word out about a graphic novel, because the people who are really supportive of graphic novels are really supportive of it. They'll go out, they'll book talk it, they'll review it, they'll talk about it on their blogs. So, you know, and especially now with the, you know, how the economics are, especially in the States, people just aren't buying books. So I think publishers are really relying on librarians to sort of help seed the market, almost, to get people to know about these books, to take them out from the library, so that they will actually go out to the bookstores and buy them. Just because there's so much stuff being published, and you know, big chain bookstores like Barnes and Noble and Borders are teetering on the verge of bankruptcy, and they're just not buying everything anymore. They're being very selective, and they're being very selective in their graphic novel purchases, because back in like 2003, 2004, when manga exploded, they bought so much of it, and then either had to deal with content issues, or they just shipped it all back because they just bought way too much, because the publishers have been saying, oh, you're going to sell so much of this, and then it just didn't happen. So it's been kind of a weird, you know, peaks and valleys for the relationships between publishers and bookstores. So that's why librarians, I think, are really important.
Are there any questions for our panel?
For like a self-publisher, what would you say, how does a self-publisher get a book into a library?
One thing, if I can say, like, I've been trying to get a master class in, so I get somebody in the field to come and come to my class and say, oh, here's what it's actually like. This is the process. This is, because, you know, you can read about it in Scott McCloud's book, The Creative Process, and you can study the theory behind it, but the practical aspect is something that that I've been having the most difficulty with. And I guess part of that, I know, is my location. You know, I was in touch with Scott Chandler about coming over, and I'm going to totally understand his circumstances. Really busy, coming from Waterloo to Belleville, you know, and but that's the big thing I'm going to work towards, and that's one of the big parts of coming to this kind of conference, where I can start meeting people who are in the field, who are actually putting something out and letting students actually see that, physically see that, and get a hold of that and understand that it's not just Marvel and it's not just DC that's doing it.
You should tell them Belleville's a friendly city. They'll be really
nice. No, they don't believe you.
And offer free author visits. Nothing thrills elementary schools like hearing that we can get a free author to come. But then, of course, the flip side of that is you have to be good. because teacher librarians talk to each other a lot. And there will be, oh, I heard, you know, this person contacted me. You know, how are they with the author visit? You know, how well do they present their material and make the kids enthusiastic? So sometimes word of mouth helps a lot in self-publishing, and also hooking up sometimes with vendors.
Yeah.
As someone in a public library who gets quite a lot of self-published materials, we generally, I don't want to dissuade you, but we generally don't put in self-published material unless we can, because it doesn't usually meet our criteria for inclusion in the collection. That's my standard line, by the way. This does not meet the criteria for inclusion in the collection. So if you get a work self-published, one really important thing for me would be reviews. Like reviews. Get anyone to review it. Like the Picayune Times, like anyone. And that will all help to the package that comes to me. So if I get a book in the mail and it says with a note saying, I self-published this book, please put it in the library, the chances are basically zero that it's going to get in.
And just to add, for the first 10 years of my working career, it's all been self-published, and it's exactly that way. What got them into libraries was reviews in Time, Discover. I have a very weird review history, I guess. I'm probably the only graphic novelist who's been positively reviewed in Vampirella magazine and Physics World. So I think I've covered it. I haven't had everything in between, but I just wanted to reiterate. It's possible because it's happening. And I think it is, in fact, the reviews, because that's what a teacher librarian, a librarian in a school library, a librarian in a public library can point to and say, somewhat objective source has endorsed this. It's not merely my personal opinion as a librarian that I kind of like this work.
Also, as you said, word of mouth. And I think that, I know I have two of Jim's works in my library, and I think I selected them because they were recommended through the graphic novels and library listserv. So that's probably where I got the awareness of them, right, and to know that other people consider them high quality work.
Yeah, I would highly recommend going that route, like trying to get reviewed and things like that, become, you know, recognized legitimately so that you don't have to offer your services for free. You should be paid.
Because you can make some good money on
this. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just want to ask a little bit about, you guys were talking about some of the review process that comes in, about how you can determine whether a graphic novel would be appropriate for a certain age group, or even if you could really bring it into school, you know, at all. And while I get that point, if you don't want to change the work, there is some value in knowing, hey, who can you reach out to find out, gosh, if you just changed that panel so it was like mid thigh down instead of the hip, we would have been in a whole different ballgame. Well, how do you, you know, when you're creating, how do you reach out and find out, I'd like to be exposed to this audience, I want to just be responsible about how I put it out there, being honest with what I'm doing, but also saying, yeah, hip, thigh, like, this is what you get, you know, teenagers, give them a chance to see what we're up to, then yeah, let's do it.
One good way would be to go to your public library and see what they have where, and like, where do they have Rama 1/2, and if they've got it in teen, then you'll know that you can show pared-down nudity. So if they have it in adult, so that, like, going to your public library would be, and if someone called me and said, hi, I'm a graphic novelist, and I want to know, like, just how much cleavage can I show in my, well, no. I would be willing to talk about that.
I'm going to just agree again. The very first thing I did when I was asked to do a couple YA novels was head over to the public library and see what YA graphic novels look like. What's in them, what's not. I missed the no smoking thing. I just didn't notice that it wasn't there. But oftentimes the concern is more along the lines of language, what you show in terms of body parts, and what people do to each other physically, be that punching or more gentle
caressing.
And so, yeah, that was the first step, actually, of a process. And I think that's true of pretty much any writing process. If you are writing for the vampire-loving readership, You should go read some vampire novels. If somebody told me to go ahead and write something like that, I would grit my teeth and check out Twilight, I think, from the library and learn what there is to learn. And I think this goes back to the point that Lisa and Diana were both making much earlier, is that there's always something to learn from a book, even if it's not what you're looking to do yourself or looking to teach yourself or recommend. There's always some lesson there, and it's largely about going and seeing what's out there. And maybe this is what Scott was saying. Seeing where's the gap, where's the popular stuff, decide which camp you want to be in, and figure out what's missing. It sounds almost like writing to formula, though, and writing to spec, and I think that's one of the things that talking about some of the publishing companies to not be named by me, since it would be inappropriate to slag on them, but writing specifically to a curriculum, specifically to a word count, specifically to a vocabulary list, that rarely works out well. So be sure it's still your book, but make sure it's your book to fit the audience that you want to reach. Because you can do it. It bugged me a little bit to have nobody smoke in a book about the space race. But it didn't bug me a lot. Because when you step back and you've had your first argument with the editor, you realize, is it really important? No, not really. So
thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay, so I'm sorry, we have to wrap up because there's another session after this. But I just wanted to extend my thanks to the panel for coming out and to all of you for attending our panel this morning. Thanks.
Thank you.